At the Olympic Games in London in July, South African double amputee Oscar Pistorius became the first athlete ever to compete using artificial limbs. His performance caused many to reconsider their notions of what amputees can accomplish and just how far the technology and design of prosthetic limbs have come. And we thought it would make an interesting topic for this week's installment to Please Explain. So we've asked Alina Grabowski, assistant research professor at University of Colorado Boulder and research scientist at the Department of Veteran Affairs in Denver, to join us, along with Mike McLaughlin, program manager for the Revolutionizing Prosthetics Program at the Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Laboratory. And we invite you, our listeners, to participate. You can give us a call at 212-433-9692 or leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. Alina, can you describe the kind of legs Oscar Pistorius uses to run?
Sure. He uses a model called the cheetah prosthesis. It's made by a company called Oser. And the prosthesis itself is made of carbon fiber. It's J-shaped, and it behaves much like a spring. So it'll store energy and return energy, but it doesn't generate any energy.
And who came up with that J-shaped design?
I believe that's through the company Oser. It's a company, I believe, from Iceland.
Uh-huh. How much do they weigh?
Let's see. They probably weigh about 2 pounds, roughly.
And are they designed specifically for running? Does he walk around on them as well?
Yeah, they're designed specifically for sprinting. So they're quite stiff. And that seems to be the best design for that specific activity where you're trying to generate power and have a real stiff response from a spring.
There was some controversy over those artificial legs. Some people thought that they gave them an advantage. Didn't you look into that?
Yes, we did. We had a team of researchers from the United States that looked specifically at Oscar and tried to understand some of the research that had been conducted on him previously, and also to sort of understand what those prostheses do. And we actually found quite the opposite. We found that, if anything, they give him a disadvantage compared to able-bodied athletes.
Mike, you're working on developing thought-controlled prosthetic limbs. Can you describe the robotic arm that you've been developing?
Sure. What we call the modular prosthetic limb was developed really to mimic all the functions of the natural limb. So we have, in your natural arm, you have about 27 or 28 degrees of freedom. So those are actually individual joints that you can manipulate. And so we've created an arm that basically can mimic just about all the motions your natural hand and arm can do. And to be able to control something that complex really requires that we be able to interface with the nervous system directly in order to be able to allow you to manipulate that arm so you can reach out and pick up an object in a very natural way.
And this requires a chip being implanted in our brains?
Well, that's one way of doing it. And that's certainly for patients who, for example, have had a spinal cord injury, is the only way you can really interface with the arm, because the natural pathways are damaged. But for somebody who's an amputee, for example, that's maybe missing the arm, say, below the shoulder or below the elbow, you can actually interface with the nerves that used to run down the arm so that we can pick up those signals to control the arm. So we have multiple ways that we can interface with it.
So people just think about moving their arms, and it moves just as it would for me?
That's the idea. And, in fact, if you ask some of the individuals that we've worked with, they will tell you that when they're operating the arm, they really are thinking about moving their arm. It's a very natural kind of motion for them.
How sensitive is it? Can the prosthetic hand make articulated movements, open a door, or hold a coffee mug?
Yes. Again, it can do just about anything your natural hand can do. So we can form very complex grasp. We can manipulate each finger individually. We have a thumb that has what we call 4 degrees of freedom, so we can do very complex motions with the thumb.
My guests are Mike McLaughlin, Program Manager for the Revolutionizing Prosthetics Program at the Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Laboratory, and Elena Grabowski, Assistant Research Professor at the University of Colorado Boulder and Research Scientist at the Department of Veterans Affairs in Denver. We are talking about prosthetic devices on today's Please Explain. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Elena, can you tell us about the prosthetic ankle devices that you're working on?
Yeah, sort of similar to what Mike was just describing about prosthetic hands, we've also done some work in trying to understand how we can make better prosthetic ankles. And so there's a company called iWalk that's out in Boston, Massachusetts, that has designed a new powered ankle-foot prosthesis. And so I'm looking at that and testing that during slope locomotion, so walking and running up slopes and down slopes, trying to understand how we can make that device better.
In the past, a prosthetic leg would just have a hinge, and there would be something foot-shaped, and people walked perfectly well with them. What does this do to improve that?
Yeah, actually, it's the opposite of what you just described. In the past, we've had prosthetic devices for the ankle that are springs, similar to the cheetah prosthesis I described earlier, but a more compliant spring. And it actually doesn't have any sort of hinge on it. And so in the past, people have had trouble moving with those devices. It costs them a lot more energy to move, and their biomechanics or the way that they move is not as effective as they would with their natural leg.
And these are battery-powered?
Yeah, the new device is battery-powered, and it does have a hinge joint, so it's improving upon the previous design dramatically. And it's got a battery that operates a motor, and so that's able to effectively sort of mimic what a normal gait would look like, and it pushes off just like your ankle would push off.
I'm assuming people have to learn to walk with these artificial legs. What's that process like?
They actually seem to adapt remarkably fast because it is a very effective device, and it can give a lot of power, but you can adjust that for each person. So I actually think the adaptation process is pretty fast.
Mike, is the approach to arms very different from the approach to leg design?
There's some similarities, we are much more dependent upon our ability to really interface with the nervous system. For example, some of the techniques have been used in lower extremities, as Elena mentioned, utilize springs and things to help with gait motion. When you think about what your upper limb does, you have a much wider range and therefore much greater level of complexity. And that's always been the challenge in upper extremity prosthetics. And, in fact, most amputees today, or very many of them, still wear a hook. And, the basic technology has not changed for many years. And so by enabling the limb to be interfaced with the nervous system directly gives us the ability to have a much wider range of control to mimic what the natural hand and arm does.
How do you figure out things like speed and pressure with the robotic arm? Is that just controlled by the nervous system?
Well, okay, so that's an interesting question. And so what we have also built into the prosthetic limb is a series of sensors which allow us to do things like sense the pressure which I'm pressing against, say, a tabletop or grasping a cup. Vibration. So if I slide my finger across a surface, I can get a sense of the roughness. And so what we're just beginning to do is to learn how to take that information and actually stimulate the nervous system in order to provide some level of sensory feedback.
So you're attaching these things to the nerves that are exposed after amputation?
Well, there's several things that we can do. So one is that the nerves that, for example, after an amputation that used to run down, say, to control my hand, are still embedded in the residual limb. And so when I think about moving that hand, that signal now goes down. It just has nowhere to go. So one method we have is a surgical technique called targeted muscular reinnervation, in which we take that nerve and actually The surgeon attaches it to a piece of unused muscle. So now when you think about opening and closing your hand, that nerve then stimulates a piece of muscle, and we can actually sense that with a surface sensor, so we don't have to actually penetrate the skin at all. And then we can use that information in which to control the limb system.
What about the devices that require a chip to be implanted in the brain? How do you test something like that?
Well, what you can do is you can there are well-established areas of the brain associated with motor control. And if you put somebody who has been has had a spinal cord injury and has not been able to move their limbs for many years in a functional MRI, and you ask them to imagine moving their arm, you actually see those areas of the brain light up. And so you can pinpoint the general locations in which the neural activity occurs, and then you basically, that's where you want to place your chip in order to control the arm.
Elena is designing legs that are responsive and flexible that can absorb the shock of walking and keep a person balanced. Is that tricky?
Yes, I believe it is. Because you're trying to mimic something that is so complex as the foot, similar to the hand and arm, you've got to account for all the different movements that we can make in our ankle. So, yeah, I believe it is a little bit tricky. And then if you do have a motor to drive that foot and that ankle, I think it's really challenging to keep the motor size small and the weight down.
What about knee joints? I'd imagine they're even more difficult to create.
Yeah, I haven't done a lot of work with knee joints at this point in my career, but also very complicated because of the timing and how that knee responds to certain perturbations. And then what's below the knee is also important. So if you have, say, this new powered prosthesis, ankle-foot prosthesis below the knee joint, you have to accommodate for that and change the design of the knee a little bit.
You worked for a time in the biomechatronics group at MIT, where Hugh Herr has been doing work on knee prosthesis. You weren't involved in any of that?
Not in the knee prosthesis, no. I was more involved with the ankle.
Now, Oscar Pistorius complained at the Paralympics that his opponent had an advantage because his blades were longer. Does that make any sense?
Potentially, yes. No one has done research into sort of artificially increasing leg lengths. So I think that there's a lot more research to do there and to try to understand what changes mechanically if you boost your height up to sort of an unnatural level. And with bilateral amputees, it's hard to decide what the appropriate height is. The Paralympic Committee this year changed their rules, and that's why you saw a lot of bilateral amputees having heights that seemed a little bit tall. And I think that's really what Oscar is getting at. So I think in the future we're going to do some research and really try to understand what happens when you increase the length of a leg.
Are these prostheses custom designed to fit each person?
They would be customized in their stiffness. So say if you have a 200-pound person versus a 100-pound person, you're going to have a much stiffer prosthesis for the heavier weight person than you would for the lighter weight person. So in that way, they're customized. The socket is also very much customized, but that's not necessarily part of the prosthesis itself.
Mike, I've heard that the Pentagon is funding a lot of the new prosthetic design. Is that true?
That's true.
And that's because we're trying to take a new approach to soldiers returning from wars, in this case Iraq and Afghanistan, where many of them have suffered some an amputation of one sort or another?
That's correct. Jeff Ling, who is a neurosurgeon at the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA, about 6 or 7 years ago was looking at the injuries coming back from mostly Iraq at that time, and really saw that what was available to those soldiers, the technology really had advanced minimally over the past 100 years, and so his goal was really to make a very radical leap in the available technology that could help those soldiers, and ultimately, you know, help anybody that would have a need for an upper extremity limb replacement.
Well, in the past, one size fit it all. I remember a film by the great Iranian filmmaker Mossad Makhbalbaf, a film called Kandahar, that starts off with an airdrop of prosthetic limbs, and people who had lost their limbs in Afghanistan due to landmines all go racing after them the best they can. And I guess she just found one that came closest to the length that was required. Obviously, we're talking about something quite different these days. Okay, well, I thought you might respond, but we're going to take a little break. And when we come back, we'll take listener calls and follow up on these things. Our number here is 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. Or you can leave a comment or question on our show page at WNYC.org. My guests are Mike McLaughlin, Program Manager for the Revolutionizing Prosthetics Program at the Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Laboratory, and Elena Grabowski, Assistant Research Professor at the University of Colorado Boulder. We're talking about prosthetics on today's Please Explain. We are back with our Please Explain look at prosthetics with Elena Grabowski, Assistant Research Professor at the University of Colorado Boulder, and Mike McLaughlin, Program Manager for the Revolutionizing Prosthetics Program at the Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Laboratory. And we are taking your calls at 212-433-9692. You can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org, and a couple of people have already left comments. A listener asked, do you have any information on advances for people with toe amputations besides the traditional inserts worn in shoes? I guess that's for you, Elena.
Yet, not that I know of yet, but, you know, I think in time a lot of technology will advance in that direction. But, yeah, nothing that I know of yet, unfortunately.
And John wrote on our show page, do rotating motors still lead the way in making prosthetics move, or are motors that move in a straight line, like muscles, starting to get used?
In the power prosthesis, the lower limb power prosthesis, we have a series of elastic actuators. So the motor actually drives a bolt, basically, and that's how that works. But yeah, I think as technology gets better, motor designs will get better, and we'll keep working on that.
Mike?
So for upper extremity prosthetics, we're using rotating motors. And that's driven by the fact that we need to really be able, particularly for the hand, put a large number of motors in a very confined space.
Let's take some calls. Our first caller is, I don't know how to read this name because it's got an L and a J at the beginning. But you're from New Jersey? Is it something like Lendrand? Hello? Okay, we're going to put you on hold for a second. And Andy from Westchester, hi, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. Yeah, I'm a CPO, a prosthetist, and I just had a question about the implants in the brain. I saw a recent study that there's actually a chip can be placed in a part of the brain where there's a centralized coordination of movement. Do we have any comments on that?
So we're looking at, in our effort, several different areas of the brain. Basically, the motor areas of the cortex, which are involved in actually making decisions to implement motion, and then areas of the brain called the postparietal area, which is involved in planning. And so we are looking at kind of multiple areas, and as part of our studies, we're going to be looking at kind of the pros and cons of various locations.
Can I make one more comment, too? Do you know about artificial muscle fiber and whether that's making any advances?
So there is some work. We're not involved in it with our effort, but there is work continuing in artificial muscle. It's still, I think, a bit out there in terms of the ability to utilize it within a kind of a practical prosthetic, but I think it is potentially a very, very exciting development in the future.
Yes, I think so too. All right, thank you very much.
Thank you for calling. And sure. Our next caller, we're going back to Legendron. Hi, you're on the air. Legendron, you're listening. You're not listening through the phone. You're listening through the radio. We have a little delay. So could you go to your phone and start talking? Okay, well, I'm going to put you on hold again. But for future callers, we have a delay. So if you go away from your telephone, you're not going to know when I put you on the air. J.W. from New Jersey, hi, you're on the air.
Good afternoon. This is J.W. from Blairstown, New Jersey. I was wondering if you could tell me, there are many touch and temperature sensors on the body, and I was wondering if these are each individually connected directly to the brain through an individual nerve fiber or whatever you may call it, or are these signals somehow multiplexed over a single fiber?
So the answer to that, it depends upon where you're actually interfacing with the nervous system. So if you are connecting to the peripheral nerves, so those are the nerves that say used to go down my arm before the amputation, there you can correlate an individual nerve fiber to a location. So I can stimulate a specific nerve and that'll correlate to a particular finger, for example. If we are, for somebody to say that has a spinal cord injury and we have to stimulate within the brain itself, it's much more complex. And so there you have to stimulate a range of neurons, and there's not a one-to-one kind of matching. And so we're just beginning to look at that now, and I think over the next year we're going to have some, I think, very exciting developments in that area. It's still a little bit early yet.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. Now, Legendron was going to ask, what about prosthetics for stroke victims? Are people working on those? Elena?
Yeah, I would say it's most likely to be more of an orthotic rather than a prosthetic. And yes, people are working on those. It sometimes will take the form of something like an exoskeleton, something that attaches outside the body, that's able to help a person move more effectively. So there is work being done in that area, but again, it's going to be much more of an external device rather than a prosthesis that's in line with the body.
And that's what orthotics are?
To a certain extent, yes.
But do they work on similar concepts?
Yes, so an orthotic is designed to help a person move effectively. So for instance, if you had a foot orthotic and you had a stroke where your toes sort of drop, it's called a drop foot gait, you would put some sort of an orthotic underneath the foot, beneath the foot, to give it that integrity to be able to swing your leg without your toe dropping.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Sherman in Brooklyn. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you? Good. I'm legally blind. My optic nerve has been damaged considerably. I wonder if there's any prosthetics or anything that can supplant the functions of the optic nerve to increase my ability to see.
Do either of you know about that? The optic nerve is actually a bunch of tiny fibers, and when they break, you lose sight. Can that ever be replaced by something prosthetic?
Yeah, so I'm aware of there is work going on looking at a visual prosthesis, but I believe that requires integrity of the optic nerve. I think it is certainly possible. It's not something that we're looking at right now, but I think that there are certainly, you know, companies and research efforts directed at that area.
Now, there are people who have artificialized glass eyes or whatever that move when the other eye moves. They're just attached to the muscle in the eye socket? Do either of you know?
I believe that is correct. I mean, those types of prostheses are meant, you know, for cosmetic appearance, not to reproduce functionality.
Well, a number of prosthetics were designed to look lifelike with painted on veins and fingernails, but the prosthetics both of you are working on are very different. They look more like robot limbs. Is that where we're going these days?
That's a very interesting question. When we started out our effort, we went through great pains, actually, to make coverings for the prosthetic that looked like the natural limb. But what we're finding out is one, I think amputees frequently care more about function. Does the arm move in a natural way? More, they care about that more than how it looks. And there are actually some amputees that really like the idea of having a robotic arm. I think it looks really cool. So it really is a matter of individual choice.
Okay, well, let's go to another caller. Jill from Boston. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm just wondering, my husband is a lower right leg amputee since 2009, and I'm wondering, is there anywhere in Boston where he could go to get some kind of newer technology for his prosthetic? We're in Boston. It's supposed to be very cutting-edge medicine, but he doesn't have a cutting edge, any kind of prosthetic, the kind that you're describing. Is there a hospital associated with these folks where he could go to even be a subject for one of these newer technologies?
Elena?
Yeah, I would encourage him to try to locate Bob Emerson, who's a local prosthetist that would be able to connect him with the right technology. You also could definitely contact the MIT Biomechatronics Group. And they would be able to help you as far as getting involved in studies, ongoing studies.
Now, how expensive would these new prostheses be?
The lower limb prosthesis right now, I believe, is around $30,000. So they're quite expensive at this point, but I think in time that technology will get a little less expensive and the price should come down quite a bit.
And are they durable?
Very, yes.
Katie, hi, you're on the air. Katie from Syosset.
Hi, I'm calling because I was curious about spinal cord injuries. I heard you talk a lot about prosthesis, but I was wondering about people who already have the limbs. Is there any functionality that you were getting with the brain chip or anything that could work in that respect? Maybe even an exterior or an exoskeleton.
Because so much of the work right now has involved stem cell research rather than prostheses.
Like ReWalk, they have something that's an exoskeleton, but I was wondering if there was anything that was more, if you were able to go to the movies, it's not really realistic for somebody for everyday activities.
Mm-hmm. So there are some groups looking at functional electrical stimulation so that they basically stimulate the muscles in order to make the muscles themselves move. That's not something that we're doing within our effort, but I do believe that what we're learning about the brain in our effort in terms of how to understand and interpret the signals from the brain will ultimately help in those types of approaches.
And there is some work being done on exoskeleton devices, something like a ReWalk, to be able to attach on the exterior of a person and help them move, and something maybe a bit more subtle than the ReWalk hopefully will come into presence here soon.
Thank you for your call. Matt from Philadelphia. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. So my understanding is that there is a difference between reflexes and cognitive decisions, and that the reflexes are they come from the spine. And I'm wondering how that's accounted for, if you can restore reflex, the ability to have reflexes in the muscles through prosthesis, what you're doing to integrate that into your future movements.
Yeah, so that's actually one of the areas that we're just beginning to look at now. That with we have about 107 sensors within the prosthetic arm, and so one of the things that we're able to do is do things like detect, say, for example, slip. I grasp an object like a cup, and it begins to slip through my hand, and be able to locally make a decision. I need to grasp that object tighter. So We're beginning to look at some of those types of things to simulate reflex types of actions. And I think we're just beginning to kind of really explore. This is a very new area for prosthetics to incorporate the level of sensory feedback. But I think that there's some really exciting things that will happen in the future.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have time just to sneak in one more call. Giuseppe from Jersey City, you had a question for Elena?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes. Very quickly.
My question is about Ostropastorius. I guess if we don't have that much time, it's not really, but if she could just speak about the process of the research, whether or not to determine he was at an advantage or disadvantage with those legs.
Yeah, we compared a few different things. We went at it three approaches, basically. We wanted to compare his energy cost for moving, for running, and so we did that and compared that to non-amputees. We compared his ability to fatigue, and we also compared his biomechanics. We found that his metabolic costs and his ability to fatigue were identical to non-amputees, but his biomechanics were very different. And that's sort of where we looked into his biomechanics further and thought that actually his prosthesis might give him a disadvantage rather than an advantage.
And we have to leave it there, unfortunately. But thank you both so much for being with us on today's Please Explain. Elena Grabowski, Assistant Research Professor at University of Colorado Boulder. Mike McLaughlin, Program Manager for the Revolutionizing Prosthetics Program at Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Laboratory. It's been a real pleasure talking with you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.